Thinking about renewal is not for the faint of heart. Because I'm not talking about the brand new gym membership or the resolutions that may not last, but the process of turning over, maybe starting over, and slogging through and making it stick. Hi, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is the Marketplace Weekend podcast for the weekend of January 2nd, 2015. Just about any economist you ask will say this year looks to be better than last. But taking that new year and finding your place in it, that's where the real work comes in. We want to hear your stories of renewal. Visit our website at marketplaceweekend.org or stop by Marketplace's Facebook page or tweet us. We're at Marketplace WKND. Now let's start the first show of 2015 and round up your economic week in 20 seconds.
General Motors has kicked off 2015 with more recalls. Listen to this. GM is recalling 83,000 SUVs and trucks for ignition issues.
A former Soviet republic, Lithuania is the last of the three Baltic states to enter the Eurozone.
Gas prices are now at their lowest level in more than 4 years.
We're going to start our show about renewal with a story on reclaiming some of the basic things it means to be human. I'm talking about the messy, halting process of rebuilding the lives of former child soldiers, specifically in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore spent 2 weeks reporting a series of stories in Congo, and he joins me now. Hi, Sabri.
Hi, Lizzie.
Welcome back. You did this reporting trip to the Democratic Republic of Congo, and you reported on child soldiers reintegrating back into society. Tell me about what you saw and who you met.
I visited a couple schools for people who used to be kids and who were child soldiers. These are people who were abducted often into various militias, and they spent their childhood at war. One of the people I talked to was a woman named Rachel. She's in her 30s now, but when she was 16, she was raped by 5 or 6 fighters in a militia while she was trying to hide in her family home. Here's how she talked about it.
I didn't feel like I had any value in the neighborhood anymore, so I decided to become a soldier. I wanted people to fear me, to respect me. They knew that I could kill them or hit them or do something to them, that I had the capacity and spirit to do so.
When she returned, this tough guy persona was a liability. This was the case for a lot of male former child soldiers, too. You know, they had trouble reintegrating.
People said, that's a soldier. She'll kill us. She'll be a thief.
What we heard there was her speaking with translation. When you think about this issue of reintegrating child soldiers back into society, renewing who they are, I mean, our show is about renewal this week. What worked in terms of getting them back into the mix and what didn't?
That's a very good question, and that is a question that's been asked by a lot of people who have been trying to help these kids. And what did not work was giving former child soldiers a little bit of cash or a kit of household goods or a goat and leaving after 3 months and saying, hope your life works out. You know, that did not work, in part because what was needed was a way to exist economically, to earn a living, to have a purpose in the long term. And on top of that, not only do you need some sort of sustainable economic anchor in your life, you need psychological help. I mean, you can only imagine the kind of trauma that these kids went through existing in the bush at the bottom of the totem pole, starving sometimes, the object of sexual violence. I mean, look, the military is tough for normal people. Forget guerrilla arms.
For children.
I talked to Jocelyn Kelly. She's the director of the Women in War Project at Harvard's Humanitarian Initiative, and they did a study on what worked and what didn't. Here's what she had to say.
Mental health can be almost a way to achieve economic success, and economic success can also be a way to improve mental health. So if you don't have that just basic capacity to engage with people, to overcome anxiety or symptoms of PTSD, you're not going to be able to be engaged with a job in any way, shape, or form.
And, you know, as she said, likewise, getting a job, getting a trade, it's a way to improve your mental health. You feel like you have a purpose. You feel you have some kind of worth. So, you know, to the extent that programs offered an economic route and a psychological route, they were more successful.
Sabri, you had been in the DRC during some of the military instability, let's say, after some of the wars. When you returned on this trip, was there something that stuck out and surprised you while you were reporting these stories?
Well, One of the things, I don't know that it surprised me, but it certainly stuck out, was how busy the streets were and how sort of active things were compared to when I was last there, which was at the height of one of the various rebel invasions that approached Goma, the eastern capital there. I mean, that was heartening to see. Obviously, this place has built itself up quite a bit. But I'll tell you, one thing that did shock me was on the psychological side of these child soldiers. Some of the skills that they were missing, you know, when they came out of the jungle, they were very basic. Here's Jocelyn Kelly again.
You're allowed to make eye contact with people. It's okay to disagree with people when you're having a conversation. You are valuable as a person, and you have the right to express your own opinion and to determine your own future. I mean, these are the skills that are so incredibly human and basic, but often, especially young girls who are in armed groups, had no idea that this was something that was available to them in civilian communities.
We're talking about renewal and rebuilding on this show. Economically, you also reported on the coffee industry in Congo and what is becoming a way to actually earn some money.
The economic entity that is the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo needs to rebuild. And an industry is like a mirror. It is really easy to smash. It is much harder to put back together. And you have all these moving parts, financing for exporters, a mill, government assistance, buyers, foreign buyers. That is all very hard to put back together, but that's what a lot of groups are trying to do. And from what I saw, it looked very promising, especially in the coffee. You know, coffee used to be really great there. Then it sort of died back during the war. And it looked very promising. There were thousands of people joining these coffee cooperatives trying to sell their goods. So we'll see.
Marketplace's Sabri Benishore, thank you so much for your reporting from Congo and for talking with us.
Liz, you're very welcome.
Not all stories of renewal are about big transformations. A new year can also bring some more prosaic changes. For example, what we pay for things. That's often how events in the macro economy show up in our daily lives. You heard Sabri Benishore mention coffee in the previous story. That's one of the goods that will likely cost more this year. Mark LoCastro made a list of several things where we'll pay a little extra, and he's a shopping expert at DealNews.com. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
So we're looking into the new year. We're talking about where the economy is going to intersect with our lives, and that's often in the things we buy. Your list of what's going to cost more, I don't know. Item number one is really depressing. Coffee and bourbon?
Yeah, that's right. So the thing with bourbon is earlier in the year, there was a shortage announcement by Buffalo Trace, and everyone thought it was a marketing ploy to drive up prices and demand, but a spokesperson for the company confirmed that the shortage is very real. Within the last 5 years, sales of domestic bourbon have increased 36%, and that's largely because of a craft cocktail movement. So a lot of these bourbon distilleries are rationing their bottles. Doing so, they're raising their prices.
Right. This is basic economics 101, supply and demand. The supply has dwindled and the demand has risen.
Exactly. You know, demand has outstripped supply, and that's the reason for a lot of these price increases in 2015.
Now, what about coffee? That's pretty essential to my mornings.
Of course. I mean, everyone loves coffee. And the reason here is that there is a drought in Brazil. And Brazil is, of course, the world's largest grower of coffee. And this is causing all price increases among a wide variety of brands like Folgers, Dunkin' Donuts, Maxwell House, and even Starbucks.
We're talking about drought in a wider context here, too, because there's obviously been severe drought in the western half of America and in California. What kind of ripple effects are we going to see on different types of food in the new year?
So I think the number one thing that people are going to be affected by here from the western drought is avocados. People are eating too many avocados. I guess people really like guacamole.
I do.
And California supplies roughly 95% of the U.S. supply. And because they're having a severe drought there, it's really taking a toll. Expect prices on avocados to skyrocket.
Yeah. But do we also see this, though, you know, when you think about growing cycles, a lot of agricultural products both are produced for their own, but also are used in animal feed. Do we see that carried into, say, pork and beef prices, do you think?
A lot of things are interconnected, and, you know, beef and pork. For pork, there is increased demand, there's a pig-killing virus, and higher feed costs. So bacon and pork is going to cost a little bit more in 2015, which is, of course, unfortunate.
I want to move to an area where a lot of Americans spend a tremendous amount of money, a lot of our GDP goes to this, which is healthcare. And, you know, this is a complex one because we're still seeing parts of the Affordable Care Act go into place, and those have changed the calculation, both making things cost more and cost less. Do we have a sense of how this is shifting out in 2015?
A couple of reports are indicating that medical costs will increase roughly by 6.8% in 2015. Now, there was a survey done that found 85% of employers are implementing or considering increasing employee cost sharing within the next 3 years, and 18% of employers are now offering a high deductible health plan as the only health insurance option for employees. So healthcare is definitely on the rise.
Oil is down dramatically. I suspect that's going to filter into a lot of other products, which might be cheaper this year.
Gas prices will average about $2.60 per gallon in 2015. So in 8 states, prices could slip even below $2 a gallon. This is fantastic for consumers. That means they have more money in their pocket, which should in turn add momentum to retail and sales.
Mark LoCastro is a shopping expert and a spokesman for DealNews.com. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
The 2015 job market asks a lot of workers, and one thing that comes up frequently is the idea of retraining. So we're going to start this story of renewal by going back in time to March of last year. Patsy Price, a manager at Google, decided to take a leap and switch fields to become a computer coder. Here she is talking to Marketplace as part of a series we did on work with the New York Times. You'll also hear a little bit of Times reporter Paul Sullivan.
My job was pretty great, but I felt obsolete.
So Price signed up for an intensive 12-week class at General Assembly, one of a handful of new schools around the country where you can learn to code quickly, sometimes in a day, sometimes weeks. It wasn't easy. The code was hard to learn, and the grandmother of two found the students were a lot younger.
I like to think of myself as a 1956 T-Bird, and I'm going in and I'm competing against Ferraris, Maseratis, Priuses.
9 months later, we tracked down Patsy Price. She said that after the story ran, lots of people thinking about changing careers got in touch.
The number of people that reached out to me to ask me about, you know, transitioning and what they should do, I was very, very surprised at this, and I did have 4 or 5 people that came back to me later saying that they made that transition, and they found the experience to be very similar to mine.
You said you felt like a 1956 T-Bird up against Maseratis, Ferraris, and Priuses. How do you feel now?
Well, I would say that I'm not exactly a Tesla yet. I still have some catching up to do. I will admit that being a little bit older than my colleagues, I don't feel as agile in some ways and able to pick up things as quickly. However, I'm working on that, and I'm working to code faster and to catch up. So I'd say, you know, I'm kind of like a Mustang now.
Price, who did find a job after coding school with the company SmartZip, makes less money than she did at Google, but she feels she's more in tune with the 2015 economy.
It's really deeply satisfying to know that I can sit down and build something from scratch. I was looking at my career trajectory and what I wanted to do, and I wanted to make sure that I was employable and had useful skills.
Let's say I came to you or somebody else and said, I'm thinking about trying to get a new kind of job. The price tag on some of these programs is pretty high. What would you say?
Well, the first thing that I would ask you is, how much are you willing to devote to learning a new skill? Then also, what kind of lifestyle do you want? And are you able to transition your lifestyle into something that might not have as much disposable income? But to me, I think I have a much richer life now, and I really appreciate it.
We also caught up with another person from our story in March, Jake Schwartz, CEO of General Assembly, the school Price went to for her intensive coding classes. A full 12-week class runs just over $11,000. In 2014 may have felt like the year when everyone decided they were going to learn to code, but Schwartz says there's more to retraining for the new economy.
It's not just coding. Coding is a nice thing to have. A lot of the world is built on code now, so I do agree a certain level of literacy is required. But I do think that coding as the be-all and the end-all for what we need as a society in terms of our economy is definitely overblown. There's a whole host of skills out there, and there's a whole host of disciplines that require new talent to come in and inject new life in it as we sort of head towards the future.
Say you walk away from your job to take this class, any of your classes. Is it worth the risk?
It's worth the risk if you are truly committed to putting in the time and the effort and the energy to learning this new skill and going through the process of connecting into the community and taking ownership over your life. General Assembly, our entire staff, our instructors, our career coaches, our curriculum designers are all right there behind you. But at the end of the day, this is really about motivation and commitment. And for what we've seen, students who are committed succeed.
Right now, government data show that the economy is improving. One indicator is that more people are quitting their jobs, basically because they think they'll be able to find something better. We went to Grand Central Station in New York to talk to people about whether they think 2015 might be the year they look for a new job and what kind of skills they need to land one. Doug Towns works for the State Department in Washington, D.C. His two kids are both recent college graduates and both with degrees in art and design. He's worried they're going into a really tough market.
Markets are saturated with graduates and there's no one there. As far as myself, I don't have any plans of changing jobs. I'm secure. And with the economy the way it's going, you know, I need to stay in a secure, you know, job field.
My name is Mike Perez. I'm from Staten Island, New York.
What kind of work do you do?
Work for Staten Island Ferry. Because the way I feel is like there's a lot of jobs out there, you just gotta look for them, you know? Don't give up.
You're in the military?
Yes.
What do you have to know how to do, and what kind of skills do you have to get a job now, do you think?
I was looking for a job for 2 years, and I was about to reemploy because nobody wanted to hire me because I had no license. The military don't give you no license. They give you skills, experience, but no license, so.
What kind of work do you do?
I am working in a dental office at the moment. I'm managing a dental office at the moment.
How do you feel about the job market right now?
I have looked around to see what's out there, and it's not as good as I would have hoped it would have been.
What's the ultimate dream?
Well, the ultimate dream is to do something on our own. Right now I'm working in a dental office. I have a couple of friends in dental school, and it would be a dream to maybe open something with them.
Yeah. What kind of training do you think you need to have in order to move forward right now?
I think I'd probably need to go to school. Probably need to go back to school.
How do you feel about that idea?
I'm open to it, but that's also dependent on how good the economy is and how easy it would be to get loans. Everything is intertwined. Everything is connected.
That's Fidenima Olagu. The catch-22 she mentioned, that you can't get a job unless you get new skills, and the investment you need to make to get those new skills might be too expensive. That's one of the central issues when it comes to thinking about retraining. Carl Van Horn is a professor of public policy and workforce development at Rutgers, and we played him that clip of Olagu describing her retraining dilemma.
That's the difficult judgment that people have to make when they decide to go into training, because they need better information. And what information do they need? They need to know, for example, that this training program actually is successful, and so we need more transparency about the results of training programs that is publicly available. Because otherwise, you're really just taking a guess that the training you're engaging in, wherever it is, whether it's a college or at a community-based organization, is actually going to pay off.
The Labor Department put about $1 billion into job training programs this year. Does that pay off?
It's a tough question to answer in general, but I would point out a couple of things. First of all, even though it sounds like a lot of money was put into that program, at the end of the day, there's just a little over 100,000 people who received any significant support for job training from the government. Most training programs actually occur inside companies. They spend much more money on training than any government program by a factor of 10. So what does that mean? Well, obviously that doesn't help people who are unemployed because they're not working in those companies. So you have to get into the companies. And that's why I emphasize a pathway which requires some short-term training, which can get you into a company.
What kind of skills do you think workers need to have to move them forward?
Well, in many cases, what they need is a little bit of short-term training, meaning a bit to brush up their skills. Their skills may have atrophied while they were unemployed. In other cases, they need just basic understanding about how to search for a job. If you think about an older unemployed worker, for example, many of them don't know how to use social media, which is the way in which many employers find their workers these days. Because the last time they looked for a job, there was nothing like Facebook or LinkedIn. And that's why we always tell people who are unemployed for any period of time that the best thing they can do is to stay connected to the network and expand their network of friends and associates. Anything to keep yourself in the loop, so to speak.
Carl Van Horn, Distinguished Professor of Public Policy at Rutgers University, thank you so much.
Thank you.
About renewal this week, and after that story about retraining, we wanted to get a little more practical. How do you get that new 2015 job? We're going to talk to a career coach, but first, we wanted to know what's on your mind about the job market now. Here's a peek.
Hopefully, yes. I just graduated, so I'm hoping the market is better.
It is very difficult because the economic situation and then having no income, and I'm hopeful that I will find a job next year. Yeah.
Right now I'm a barista at a Starbucks. That's not what I want to do for the rest of my life.
If I get, take the right steps, I'll have my own app. I won't have to work for nobody no more, so.
I've been unemployed for 6 months now, so it's, half a year. That's a lot, yeah.
Well, yeah, it's frustration because, they won't call you back if you don't have an experience. So you just need to put your foot in the door.
Don't you think a lot of colleges are ripoffs, the amount of money they charge for the kind of work that you're able to get?
Even though you look for a job and then each day I wake up thinking, okay, today's going to be the day and tomorrow. And then the days go by, then the months go by, and then you're still in the same place.
Arnie Fertig is the founder and CEO of JobHunterCoach.com. Welcome to Marketplace Weekend.
Thank you, Lizzie. It's great to be with you.
We heard one of the women in that tape that we played say, every day she wakes up thinking today is going to be the day. Hunting for a job is exhausting. When you talk to people, before we even get to practical tips, are there mindset tips that you have?
I think the first thing is that people have to get out of their head the idea of being desperate. And it tends to make people flee in the other direction when they see you in that way. Yeah, sort of. People hire people because they represent a solution to a problem that an employer has. And so when you present yourself as the solution to someone else's problems, you'll have a much better chance of being seen in a positive way and see yourself that way as well.
We've been talking on the show about sort of the macro picture of retraining and gearing yourself up for the economy in 2015. But you wrote 4 New Year's resolutions that get to the practical, the micro. One of them I really liked was creating a schedule for yourself. Why is that so important?
It's easy for us to let time get away from ourselves. And I think that especially if you're unemployed and looking for work, it can be that you're just sitting at the computer all night long and at 2 a.m. just hitting click, click, click on Monster, send your resume here, there, in the next place and thinking that's a job hunt. You ought to really instead think of your job hunt as a job in and of itself. create a schedule for yourself just as you would as if you're at a job and you have certain tasks to do in certain time frames that they must be done. And then give yourself time off when you're saying, okay, I've done my job for today, now I'm off. But within the time that you are working, to understand what are the various tasks that you need to be doing. Setting up appointments for informational interviews, working on your resume, working on your LinkedIn profile and expanding your network. Create a schedule that has all of these things in it and figure out when you can do what and how much time you need to allocate to what.
How much value do you allocate to, say, LinkedIn and other online networks versus old-fashioned human networking?
I don't think it's either or. I think it's both. I think LinkedIn today is critical for any serious job hunt for any professional-level individual.
I've often thought of my experience, you know, I've got 15 years as a working journalist under my belt, that's what I lead with. But you're a little counterintuitive about this.
I think that one should lead with your value and your accomplishments rather than how long you've been doing something. Ultimately, they hire because you've shown achievement doing whatever it is that they need to be having done, that you've already done that. That's what will get you the job.
Who's the best person you've ever hired, and how did they win you over?
I've been really impressed when people simply present themselves to me as human beings with a real story. If I understand, how is it that a person went from here to there to the next place? How is it that what I'm looking to hire somebody for makes a next logical progression in the arc of their career? What have they done that's been bending them toward the opportunity that I have at hand?
We've been through a very rough time in the economy, and there are people who may have lost a job or gotten downsized. Maybe they're nervous about that gap on their resume. How do you go about presenting that?
I think you have to be honest about it. However, the longer one is unemployed, the harder it is to make that case, as people have this unconscious wonderment, well, if the person is really that good, why are they still out on the street? Why hasn't somebody else picked them up? The idea is to always show what you've been doing, that you haven't just been on the sidelines, that you've continued to build your skills. You're doing something to show that you're not just staying at home watching soap operas all day. You still are that professional. You just happen to be a professional who isn't employed right now.
Are there big mistakes you've seen people make in this process?
First of all, if you're in that informational interview, don't overextend your welcome. If you said you're going to take 10 or 15 minutes from somebody, don't stay for a half an hour or an hour. Don't turn something into something it's not intended to be. If somebody says, I'll give you an informational interview, that doesn't mean it's a job interview. Those are just a few of the really basic mistakes that people make all the time.
We heard people in that tape that we listened to say they're feeling a little more hopeful about 2015. Are you, when you think about the job market?
I am. I see a lot more employers actually scrambling for work. I think in depending, of course, on what your location is and what your skill set is, on the whole, it does seem that the economy has turned the corner and that businesses are finding the need to hire once again, which is really good news for the American worker.
And if I had to, you know, go back and replay that scene from The Graduate with you and, you know, one word, plastics. What do you tell people now when they say, gee, what fields should I even think about?
It's about thinking about things that can only be done where you are, things that can't necessarily be outsourced or outplaced. It's about building your own unique set of skills so that a lot of people know A and a lot of people know B and a lot of people know C, but not everybody knows A and B and C. Then you'll be putting yourself in good stead.
Arnie Fertig is the founder and CEO of JobHunterCoach.com. Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Next week, we're focusing on inheritance, and specifically what you inherit financially. And we're not necessarily talking about money. Habits, mindsets, for better or worse. How do you handle what gets passed down? We want to hear your stories, so tell us by visiting MarketplaceWeekend.org, visit Marketplace's Facebook page, or tweet us. We're at Marketplace WKND. year could bring all sorts of new ways we get our entertainment. And for the movie industry, some new challenges. And that's where we're focusing in today's look at how you and I interact with the world of tech.
Today we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology.
I've been in the business 30 years.
Well, I haven't been in show business as long as you have, Killian. But I'm a quick learner. So I'm going to give the audience what I think they want.
This is Tech in Real Life.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Lizzie.
So, tech-ish on the big, small screen? We're talking about The Interview.
Yes, we are.
You saw it.
I did. Did you see it?
That's
okay. I think that's actually probably good because it was a pretty bad movie.
So how did you get to watch it after all this back and forth?
Okay, so they made it available on Christmas Eve, and I streamed it. I went on to, not YouTube, although it was there as well, but I went on to Google Play, which is Google's app store, and I paid for it. It cost me $6. I got the quick video on demand. Actually, Sony CEO lauded the company for doing a quick turnaround on this, getting the movie up on the internet very quickly. And it was actually pretty unlikely. Some cloud services that could have delivered the film were worried about getting hacked. And Sony ended up striking deals with Google and Microsoft cloud services to stream this movie on Christmas Eve. There was also a website, Sony Pictures. The website was called seetheinterview.com, owned by Sony Pictures. Apple picked up the rear a couple days later, offering the movie. And that's sort of where we're at.
Bottom line here.
Yeah.
I want to know if Sony made money. After all, this is a business decision.
Right. Well, it depends on whether we're talking about revenue or profit, right? Sony reportedly spent some $44 million making the movie, and they did not recoup that, at least in the opening weekend. But they did make about $3 million in theaters and $15 million in online sales. The online sales figure is actually more interesting, I think, because it's actually a pretty good haul, $15 million. And because that says something about where the movie world is going, the infrastructure for simultaneous release in theaters and online is actually here now.
Well, right. So this is the next question, naturally. If it costs $6 to see the movie online, stream
yes,
it,
yes.
and, you know, $15 in the theater,
right.
somewhere around there, that seems like a price differential that can make a pretty easy decision for you.
Yeah, and I think that's part of why simultaneous theater and video on demand releases are still pretty unusual. A big part of studio revenue can come from theater ticket sales, and box office sales are more volatile than, for instance, the TV industry, right? I watched Snowpiercer at home. You heard of that movie?
Mm-hmm.
Came out last year, and it was actually available in my house at the same time it was available in theaters, and it was awesome. I loved that. It actually made $2 million more online than it did in the small theater release. It's proof to content creators that people will actually pay for this stuff if you just give it to them when they want it.
So maybe showing to them that they can make money and not have to worry as much about piracy?
Yeah, absolutely. If you look at the world of music piracy, for instance, as soon as actual effective ways of paying and playing for music online or even for free became available and user-friendly, piracy took a big dive. And the same thing has essentially been happening with movies and TV. People don't actually mind paying for stuff, but they want it at a reasonable price and they want it to be convenience. And that era is actually finally here. And that's why you see companies experimenting with this stuff slowly more and more.
I would think that if you are a big movie theater chain, you are worried about this.
I think that you are. The theater industry, though, is powerful in the movie business, so change, I think, will be slow, right? Theaters will also need to innovate, though. You've seen a rise in recent years of the gourmet movie experience, where you can, like, actually go and get a full meal.
Glass of wine,
and you know, a waiter brings it to your cushy chair, etc.
Well, I don't know where you're going to the movies.
Also, drive-ins are coming back in some places, which I think is kind of interesting and makes sense in certain areas. But you also might see theaters actually try even weirder stuff, and studios too. Think about a movie, for instance, with alternate endings that depend on how the audience in the actual theater that you're in
votes.
Like
a choose-your-own-adventure for movies?
Exactly.
you might see stuff like this and more sort of experimentation with interactivity with the actual piece of content that you're viewing. It's not smell-o-vision necessarily, but they might be playing with this stuff. And as digital distribution to theaters becomes more popular too, this stuff might actually become more economically viable for both studios and theaters. And that could be a good thing for theaters if they want to survive.
There's a larger economic and business story behind this, though, because we've sort of got Hollywood on one side, but then on the tech side, the very powerful Silicon Valley.
Yes, that is becoming more and more apparent and painful. Hollywood really wants to protect that product at all costs. Even in some of the Sony emails that were hacked, we saw these tensions. We've also seen some pretty stringent anti-piracy legislation pushed on this in recent years. On the other hand, Silicon Valley thinks of the platform as the product, and maybe also the user, I guess. So for companies like Netflix, Amazon, Google, Apple, they want people in the ecosystem spending money there so they can sell ads and leverage user data to create more content, things like that.
Just thinking about all the different ways we have to consume televised entertainment, video entertainment.
Sure.
There are things I learned how to do in 2014 that I don't even think I knew about in 2013.
Right.
Is there more coming? Are there going to be five new ways to stream stuff?
Well, this is like another interesting tension, right, that's happening where you've got way more places to watch stuff than you would have had even 2 or 3 or 5 years ago. But at the same time, a lot of these big companies really want to keep you in their ecosystem, or at least they want you to be a consistent subscriber. And that's really important to them. Maybe they don't care if you bounce around, but they want you to always be interacting with their service on a consistent basis. And it's really complicated because it has to do with licensing and all of these
and cutting deals with studios and creators.
Exactly. And so I think you're actually going to see a continued growth in this environment, but you're also going to see companies continue to try to keep you in their environment, which I think will be an interesting thing to see play out.
Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Thank you.
Thank you, Lizzie.
Get some of our tech in your life. Download the Marketplace app. You can get it from the iTunes Store or on Google Play. In the big cities of the world, a lot of infrastructure needs renewal or adaptation. Nowadays, that can mean using new technology. Think about London, where the iconic underground metro network carries up to 4 million passengers every day to and from 270 stations. Navigating your way around the tube can be challenging at the best of times. And blind or visually impaired passengers tend to rely on assistance from the underground staff. But new digital technology and specially designed smartphone apps could give them more independence. The BBC's Elizabeth Davies reports.
We're just approaching some stairs now, so take a step down now.
This isn't your everyday commute on the tube. I'm wearing sim specs, safety goggles with the lenses completely covered, to experience travelling on the London Underground as a blind person.
So we're going to take the Piccadilly line, so we're going to take a right.
Catherine Payne from the Royal London Society for Blind People is my guide.
Platform. Oh!
What did I just trip over?
Of a gentleman's rucksack.
Okay. We're with Courtney Nugent. She's a 25-year-old student, and she told me why the Underground is so important for blind Londoners like her, who can't learn to drive.
It's our way of independence. We don't have to worry about someone coming to pick us up to take us somewhere. We all like to do things ourselves. Public transport is how we would do it.
I find it pretty horrible and slightly terrifying at the best of times when I can see. It's echoey in here, there are tons of people, they're all pressed up right next to you. You know, it must be sort of a quite intimidating experience.
Yeah, definitely.
Courtney usually gets help from station staff members, who take her where she needs to go.
They might say, you know, is that your final destination? You'll say, no, I'm getting on, I don't know, the Northern Line and exiting here. So they would make sure that there's someone at the next station waiting for you once you get off the train.
That still doesn't give Courtney much independence. In March 2014, the RLSB launched its Youth Manifesto, where blind young people in England and Wales raised this issue.
I'm Umesh Pandya, also known as Umi. I'm the Associate UX Director at Us2. We read the Youth Manifesto. We identified solving the transport challenge, I guess, as something that would make a measurable difference.
Their solution is Wayfinder. Yes, spelled in that trendy tech startup way without the final vowel, a new app in its prototype phase that would help the visually impaired navigate the tube.
What we're going to do now is we're going to get to the front door of the office, and I'm going to give you some bone conduction headphones and a phone, and then Catherine's no longer going to be your guide. So when you go in, you'll hear some instructions. Just follow the instructions. You'll all be safe.
Turn left for the northern line, northbound towards High Barnet.
The app looks for these things which are called beacons. Imagine they're kind of little pods that emit a signal. Each beacon has an ID. That ID is what is emitted out. And the app looks for that signal and translates that ID into a message, whatever you want it to be.
And these are the beacons.
Oh, wow, they're tiny.
Yeah,
so it just looks like a kind of light green, well, like a rock, really, doesn't it?
And it's filled with rubber and waterproof.
So it's kind of squishy, slightly. And, yeah, you'd barely notice that if it was stuck on a wall. The app is still a long way from being ready to use on the underground. For a start, the team haven't figured out how many beacons would be needed in each tube station. The next stage is to secure a trial so the app can be further developed in the real world.
The architecture affects it as well. In this space, we've been trialling it with the walls are square and everything, but in the tube, we've got tunnels. You also have lots of people moving through it. Does the body affect the radio waves? So we need to trial that.
How would something like Wayfinder change the experience of getting the tube for you?
This app would help us be more independent, and maybe we wouldn't have to rely on members of the public or staff that work in stations. You know, at the end of the day, it's a big challenge for us anyway to be out here just travelling around. So if we've got sort of friend talking in your ear, talking, telling you which way to go, it would be a great help.
That story came to us from our partners at the BBC. A story about literal renewal, making something old into something new. She is a denim designer at The Gap. He's a veteran of the war in Iraq, and he collects odds and ends. Together, they've built a new business and a second life of sorts for very well-loved clothes. It all started with his father's Levi's.
My name is Marlo Fox, and I go by Fox.
Her name's Fox, and
my partner is Jeff
Garza. When I was growing up, my dad, he was an electrician.
Has been an electrician for Edison for almost 30 years.
I mean, he'd wear his Levi's for what they were made for, working in it, digging holes and climbing up in attics and all kinds of stuff. So he'd wear his jeans until he couldn't wear them anymore, until they're blown out and ripped up. And
he works so hard and has such a positive attitude, and you can see it in his jeans.
My dad doesn't like wasting anything whatsoever, especially his money, because he works hard for it. So he found a way to get more life out of it still, not just throw it away and make it trash. He'd start cutting the legs off, and he had a crappy little sewing machine and kind of figured out himself how to start sewing them together. And every time he'd mess up another pair of pants,
every time he used a pair of jeans, he'd sew it together to make this piece of fabric.
Add it to the blanket, and it got pretty big, pretty quick. And when we'd go camping and stuff like that, picnics, the blanket kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger over the years. And then eventually it was a really big blanket. It was just always a fun, memory of camping because it's jeans. And
so he shared this blanket that he's been making over the years.
My dad's old idea kind of was like the last spark that gave us the idea to run with it, take his idea and just go crazy with it. And we're at the Foxhole. It's in Silver Lake, California. Yeah, it's my girlfriend's in my store.
Jeff thought of the name. I go by Fox, and he's a veteran, so Foxhole, is something dug that they kind of hide behind.
I don't know, we really, really like jeans. Not really much more to it than that.
And so we met and shared all this and fell madly in love. And
it was a good coincidence when I met my girlfriend, because she's actually works as a denim designer.
I always have been making things, and Jeff has always been collecting things. So we kind of put that together, and
just kept saving our money. And one day I was walking down the street and I saw this place was for rent, and I called, and the rest is history.
Denim is, in a person's wardrobe, is the only piece that can tell history and personality. People really like holes now. In a mass market consumer trend analysis, destruction, it's called. So if you can find something that's naturally worn in, it's like a treasure, and people come here to find the treasures. We kind of take any utensils that sand, Jeff's a skateboarder, so we'll use the skateboard or any kind of rough surface to make some destructions and kind of test it out and see what looks right and what looks kind of awkward. You know, Jeff does a lot of traveling and finding these things.
You know, I had $20 in my pocket, buy a couple things here and there and stash it up over the years, and a lot of clothes.
Denim pieces.
A lot of denim.
Customized jeans.
A lot of old random cool knickknacks.
Rugs.
Yeah, we have a collecting cool crap problem for sure.
Anything you could think of, we could probably make up for you.
Jeans, you can just throw them on the ground and they take a beating. And
it just continues to get better and better and better. It never gets worse. It
can just be like stitched and fixed back up, and it's, you know, keep reliving some life into it, and
A style that'll be around forever.
I don't think it's ever going to go out of style. People will be wearing jeans forever.
My mom used to call me the cutter, because I'd cut everything and make new silhouettes.
For the most part, she's the genius that does all the sewing. It's not like you're going to a mall and you're getting the same thing as everybody else. Like, you have to find something
and you repurpose it. It gives it a new life and an individuality that makes it more valuable to someone else.
You know, take their dad's old jeans and turn them into stuff, or like, you know, shirts that are just beyond wearing that they've been holding on to for 20 years in a drawer. It doesn't do anything. Like, you know, we can sew that onto something or do something with it. So,
but with denim, you can basically rebuild the fabric, and it's this just amazing feeling of life that you can keep giving it, and you can't do that to many things in life, period. So that's why I love it so much.
And that's our show for this week. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Jenny Ament and Vanessa Smith, with help this week from Jody Avergan. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer, and Ravi Carmen is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Next week, we'll talk about inheritance in every sense of the word. Thanks for listening, and Happy New Year. This is APM.